Let's take our Bibles and turn again to Daniel chapter 11. There's so much in here, we've had to break it down into three messages. This is the second Daniel 11. And my text today is from verse 13 down to verse 35. And I want to speak with you about conflict, controversy, and corruption. You asked me to summarize what we're seeing here. Last time we looked at the unfolding of history from the time of Daniel all the way down to the end of the, up to the first century. This is described at the time of history, rise and fall of kings and kingdoms right on down to about 44 before Christ. Gives you an idea of this time period. If I had to summarize it, it was a picture of nothing but conflict, controversy, and corruption. Now you remember last time we saw, and this goes back to the first part of this chapter, where it speaks of Alexander the Great, all his exploits, but in verse 4, that his kingdom would be broken up and divided toward the four winds, is what it says there in verse 4 of Daniel 11. And that's speaking of those four generals of his that the kingdom was divided to. Now, for whatever reason, and maybe it's because those other two of those generals were not of great significance at this time, but there were two that were. And you remember, we saw last time, one was called here, as it says there in verse 5, the king of the south. That would relate to Ptolemy, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, that was over Egypt. These were Greek generals, and yet they were given authority over these different lands at the time. So Ptolemy would have been the one general that was over Egypt. That's why he's called the king of the south. Just give a little brief review here. And then the king of the north that's described there in verse 6 is Seleucid. He would have been another general that he and his descendants ruled for a while, but even though they were one under Alexander the Great, there came a time when they began to do battle with each other. This is what men do. And that's why this title I've given is conflict, controversy, and corruption. Here we see that men, even in their best state, are altogether vain. But it's describing this particular period of time, and it says there in verse 11, for example, I'm backing up a little bit from what we saw last time, that the king of the south shall be moved with choler or anger, and shall come forth and fight with him, even the king of the north. So this would be Ptolemy coming up against Seleucid, and Seleucid's son, even with the king of the north, he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. In other words, the king of the north, the king of the south being moved with rage, here's where this messenger told Daniel that he would attack him, but he would need a great multitude of soldiers from the king of the north. And the king of the north would lose in the battle. So it was not to be at this particular time. And this would have been fulfilled in one of Seleucid's children that was known as Antiochus. See, there's several Antiochuses, 1, 2, and 3. You can read their progression, that this would have been fulfilled when Antiochus III was defeated at a battle in Raphia, R-A-P-H-I-A. And because of that loss, he was forced to give back dominion over the... See, what they were really fighting over, and this is why it's significant, was over the land of Israel. Because we got one in the north and then one in the south. In between was the land of Israel. And so for a while, Ptolemy had lost power over the land of Israel, but in his anger now, he goes forth to fight the battle against the king of the north. And it says, when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up. He shall cast down many ten thousands, but he shall not be strengthened by it. In other words, he would not prevail. And he would suffer a great defeat. And so, in verse 13, it says, for the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former. So he went and sought more troops, even with the many that were defeated with the king of the south. Now, there would be more than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years. So a certain period of time went by, and he was still licking his wounds over this defeat with this general from over Egypt. And after certain years with a great army and with much riches, and in those times, there shall many stand up against the king of the south. You see how the Lord in his providence caused one to be strengthened for a while and then the other to be strengthened. And so here, also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fail. In other words, no one would be able to stand against him. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand neither his chosen people. So here again, when it speaks of his chosen people, it's talking about the Jewish people in that land, that none would be able to stand against him, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him, it says in verse 16, shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. This is speaking again of Antiochus ravaging the land. No one would be able to stand against him. This was fulfilled in Antiochus III, the same one that had suffered defeat before, that this time when he invaded Egypt, he gained control not only over the armies of Ptolemy, who would have been Ptolemy the fifth by this time, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, these are all successors, but also, as it says there, over the glorious land in verse 16, he shall stand in the glorious land. And many would rise up against the king of the south. In fact, even the Jews living in the land of Israel, they helped Antiochus the third, this king from the north, to defeat Ptolemy the fifth, king of the south. And this is because they resented the rule of the Egyptian Ptolemies. It says there that he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. He shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. So in other words, the Lord gave him that power to rule over the land of Israel at that particular time. And you can read in history that the decision of the Jews to support Antiochus III in the end would turn against him, because it says there that by his hand shall be consumed. These were ruthless leaders. Again, the reason for the title, Conflict, Controversy, and Corruption. The
very one who conquered them and promised them his protection in the end turned against them and brought much destruction. But here is again in verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. When it speaks of the upright ones there, it's again speaking of the Jewish people. In other words, these were ones that they were called upright as opposed to the rest of the world, as opposed to the heathen. But he shall also set his face and enter with the strength of his whole kingdom. He was trying to consolidate this whole area. And when you look on the map, this is a huge area. From the north, which would be what would be Iran today, actually all the way over to India, and then down, these were places that Alexander the Great had originally conquered, but now were divided to these generals, and they were fighting each other, but all the way down to Egypt. He was seeking to consolidate his power along with, as it describes there, the upright ones with him. He was looking for alliances with the Jewish people and trying to buy their loyalty. Thus shall he do. And then it says here, he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. Here comes the corruption part, the conflict and controversy and corruption. This daughter of women would refer to the daughter of Antiochus III, who gave her to Ptolemy V of Egypt for an alliance. Her name was Cleopatra, but this is not the same Cleopatra that most people know about, because that famous Egyptian woman actually lived some 100 years after this time. When I first looked at that, I thought, huh. But it's a different Cleopatra that was the daughter of Antiochus III, so she would have been Greek. And he gave her to Ptolemy. Again, this was part of his conniving. Rather than trying to win the favor of Ptolemy through another battle, then he thought a marriage alliance would be what would get it done, but to his great disappointment, the plan did not succeed because Cleopatra wasn't faithful to her Egyptian husband at all. And that's why it says here, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. It's amazing to me, as you read down every detail, was according to what the Lord said should take place. That's why we have confidence in this word, because this was written hundreds of years before it actually took place. And these heathen generals, they weren't referring to the Bible to take their marching orders. They were doing what they determined to do, but it was already written beforehand. I don't see how anybody can read the scriptures, read of the God of the scripture, not see how he is sovereign in all things, in every detail. Even with our Lord Jesus Christ, what they did to him, Book of Acts says they did not one thing more. We're talking about Herod and Pilate and the Gentiles and the Jews, but didn't do one thing more than what God himself ordained should be. This is the God of the scriptures. And so in verses 18 through 19, as we read on, we find once again where the king of the north is stopped. It says, after this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face towards the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be plow.
So this is the end, really, of this Antiochus the Third. This was fulfilled when he turned his attention toward the areas of what we would know as Asia Minor in Greece. When it speaks there in verse 18, turn his face unto the isles and would take many. And here's an interesting point in history. We've all heard of Hannibal, the famous general from Carthage. We're reading about him. Well, during this particular time, Hannibal helped him in his battle, but there was another Roman general. And here again we see, with the passing of time and history, everything taking place exactly as God said it would. There would be the end of the Greek Empire, and then there would be establishing of the Roman Empire. At this particular time, Rome was a republic, not an empire, but it would become an empire. But there was a Roman general at this particular time. His name was Lucius Scipio, and he defeated Antiochus in Greece. That's what it talks there about. A prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. And so from there, he turned, it says in verse 19, his face towards the fort of his own land. Here Antiochus III planned to humiliate Greece, but he was humiliated instead, and so he returned to the former regions, really having lost all that he gained, and that wasn't soon after that he died. Again, the Lord determined that. When it says there that he should stumble and fall and not be found, needing money because he was ravished for his treasury, he resorted to pillaging a Babylonian temple back up in the north, and ultimately was killed by enraged local citizens. That's how he died. There he was, this general, with all of these exploits, and yet died a dishonorable death. Now, verse 20, after that, there was a brief reign by a ruler that succeeded Antiochus III. It says, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. He thought, we're lacking money here, we'll just raise taxes. Well, that's not a way to win friends and influence people, is it? But within a few days, so he rose up and determined he was going to raise taxes and rebuild the kingdom that was left to him by Antiochus III. But within a few days he shall be destroyed. And it says, neither in anger nor in battle. This was fulfilled in the brief reign of another brother, Seleucus the Third. He was actually the eldest son of Antiochus the Third. And he sought to tax his dominion, including even the land of Israel. All this, he thought, when it says there he was a raiser of taxes, all this area where he held authority, seeking to increase revenues. In fact, he had planned, this Seleucus III had planned to pillage the temple in Jerusalem, but through a divine intervention was not enabled to do so. It says within a few days he would be destroyed. Actually, Seleucus was assassinated, probably by his brother, and this is the famous Antiochus now that we come to, because we've been looking at Antiochus III. But he was slain probably by his brother Antiochus IV, and he's the one that's known as Antiochus Epiphanes. That's the one we've heard about and read about before. Now, it's interesting here in verse 21, with all these others and their corruption, their rule and plotting, etc., but here particularly, this one,
The scriptures call a vile person in verse 21. In his estate shall stand up a vile person. You say, well, how could he have been any more vile than those that came before? Well, we're going to see why he's described that way, because he more than any had within him the spirit of Antichrist. But this is not referring to some future Antichrist. This is in this context. We're going down through, and this is why I'm linking these scriptures to show you that this is the fulfillment of history here. It says, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Each one seeking a different approach to try to shore up his power. So in his place shall arise this vile person. The messenger, and perhaps this is still Gabriel, had told Daniel that after that brief reign of the former king, Seleucus, the next king would be a vile person. But he wouldn't be recognized as royalty, but he'd take power by intrigue. And this would have been in his place. This was fulfilled in the successor of Seleucus III. He was named Antiochus IV. And he really didn't come to the throne legitimately. That's why it's put that way. That he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. It was strongly suspected that he had murdered his older brother, the previous king. And at this time, the potential heir of Seleucus II was actually imprisoned in Rome. So he could not take the throne. And so when it speaks of him being a vile person, that's due to his conniving. He sought this particular power, even though there was another successor that was imprisoned in Rome that should have been the actual heir. Yet, by flattery, he took the power, apart from the murder of his older brother, Antiochus IV, didn't use terror to gain power. He used flattery, smooth promises, and intrigue. Here's why I say he came in the spirit of Antichrist, because those that oppose Christ and oppose the people of God, it's with flattery. It's with deception. It's seeking to turn them away from the Lord and turn attention to themselves. History records that he flattered Eumenes, who was king of Pergamos, and another Attalus, his brother, and got their assistance. He flattered the Romans. He actually sent ambassadors to court their favor and paid them arrears of tribute. He flattered the Syrians and gained their allegiance. And that's why Antiochus IV took the title Epiphanes. That's how that name came about. It means illustrious, but some others say that it's a derivative of the word Epimanes, which means madman. Either one would apply. So let's see then in verses 22 to 27 how once he had gained this power, and again, here we see God's sovereignty, where the will of God is accomplished even through the connivings and the corruptions of creatures, that in the end, although man seeks his own will to do his will, yet it's God's will that is accomplished. Here in verse 22, it says, and with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work what? Deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Speaking of his advancements, now that he had the power. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand. God purposed that that rule of Ptolemy should not in any way hinder him, even though his brother had done battle, now him, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of a portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief about the king of the north and the king of the south. They shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper. Yet the end shall be at the time appointed. When it says the end here, it's not speaking of the end of time. It's talking about the end of their rule, that it would be at the time appointed. Even there, it's clear that it's God determining these things. Like Paul says over there in Acts chapter 17, that the Lord determines the bounds of men's habitations. And certainly we see that here. But again, he would act deceitfully. That's the key word that we read up here in verse 23. That there would be he's making these covenants with people, alliances. That's what he's talking about. And making league with him, but works deceitfully. This is what, again, the messenger told Daniel, that the new king of the north, the vile person, would attempt a deceitful covenant with the king of the south. But this would fail, and then there would be a great battle that would not change the balance of power. The balance of power is in God's hands. And even in our day, when we see all these shifts, people worried about which nation is gaining power over the other. Well, who's determining all this but God himself? He shall stir up his power. That's what it says there. And this was fulfilled when Antiochus Epiphanes carried on the feud between the dynasties, but pretended friendship and alliance to catch them off guard. And despite massive efforts and epic battles, Antiochus Epiphanes did not stand, and his army was swept away in the end. I'm skipping over a lot of history, but you can go back and read about it. The defeat of Antiochus Epiphanes was during his second campaign against Egypt. Because Egypt beat Antiochus with the help of Rome, and at the end of it all, Antiochus Epiphanes and his kingdom were brought under the dominion of Rome. That's the important thing to see here. There's a transition now, as God said would be, where that third kingdom would fall and the fourth would be established, which is the Roman kingdom. In fact, in a famous battle, the Roman navy defeated the navy of Antiochus Epiphanes. After the battle, a Roman general drew a circle around Antiochus in the dirt and demanded to know if he would surrender and pay tribute to Rome, and demanded to know before he stepped out of the circle. This is an interesting little anecdote. And from that point, there was no doubt Antiochus Epiphanes took his orders from Rome and was under Roman dominion. Now, what it says here, that those of his own table, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. You see that in verse 26. This is how his end came. Yea, they that feed the portion of his meat shall destroy him. His army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. This was fulfilled
in the treachery against Antiochus IV by his own counselors. So all of this took place exactly as the scriptures declared. It says, they that feed of the portion of the meat shall destroy him. The Egyptian court, there was a young king who told me again, Philometor was his name, and he was full of treachery and intrigue. And at the center was the king's brother, Sicon. And the Ephida told me was generally supposed to have been attributed to this treachery by members of his court who betrayed him to Antiochus. But verse 27, both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief. Knives were drawn. They shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. There it is again. No matter what these determine, the end would be when at the time appointed. The Lord himself would determine. And I believe that this, even with regard, because much of this battle was over Jerusalem, it was over Israel. That's where the fight was, to have that land, that dominion. And yet, when it says here, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed, that may well be referring to the appointed time of the ultimate destruction of Jerusalem, which would take place in AD 7. Not at this particular time. Not with Antiochus Epiphanes attempting to overthrow it. And so again, the Lord directed all of these things. So verses 28 to 35, we'll wrap up with this. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward south. There it is again, at the time appointed. But it shall not be as the former or as the latter, for the ships of Shittim shall come against him. Here, Shittim is Rome. Here's where we see Rome becoming more and more of an influence in this battle. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with whom that with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice. And they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he keep corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong. He's talking about what was taking place in the land of Israel. All of this battle going on, that there was a remnant. It says that people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. In other words, those that know their God, they know their God because he knows them. He strengthened them. And they that understand among the people, were they but his elect. Those that during this time would stand for the truth shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by sword many days. Those that will face great persecution. Now when they shall fall, they shall be hoping for a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. So here's where we see where this vile person, that his heart would be moved against the holy covenant, it says there in verse 28. So when this vile person returned to his land, he would attack the land, the people, and the temple of Israel. That's who is speaking up there against the Holy Covenant, because that's where God purposed that his name should dwell, in that temple, in that
city. And it would be at the same time a time of great courage, but also great treachery among those who were the Lord's. So it says, he shall do damage and return to his own land. This was fulfilled when he returned from Egypt. He was bitter from his defeat in Egypt, so he vented his anger against Jerusalem, which was already shaken because Antiochus had sold the office of the high priest and persecuted the Jewish people. He's wanting to get them to conform to the Greek culture and forsake the faith. And while returning to his land with great riches, having failed in his invasion in Egypt, he returned home with only great plunder to soothe his wounded pride. But the ships, it says there in verse 30, of ship, I said that's the Romans. They helped the Egyptians turn back Antiochus Epiphanes. But the part that I want us to end up with here is this part here where it says that he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. He was actually lashing out against God himself, the God of Israel. And it says there that he would pollute the sanctuary. Verse 31, arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination to make a testament. It's recorded that Antiochus Epiphanes set up an image of Zeus at the temple altar, and he demanded sacrifice to this image, and later desecrated the temple by sacrificing a pig on it. You may have heard that. This is what took place at this time. So it says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he would corrupt with flattery. In other words, he was getting the people of Israel to join him in doing wickedness against God's covenant. And here it is, the distinction again between the wicked and those of God's choosing. Verse 32, the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And Antiochus Epiphanes turned on Jerusalem. Jewish people were divided. That's why it says they're the people that do know their God. Not all are Israel that are of Israel. And some of them, for peace's sake, embrace the Greek culture. But even that, the Lord purposed. That's why even in the when Christ came into the world under the Roman Empire, the Greek influence was still very great. Our New Testament is written in Greek. The Greek language. But those who knew their God made a stand for righteousness in the face of this incredible persecution of this day. What kind of righteousness? All that that temple represented is a type and picture of the Lord Jesus Christ. The Lord had his remnant among them. But at the same time, it would be a time of great persecution, as it says there in verse 33. In his attack on Jerusalem, Antiochus Epiphanes is said to have killed over 80,000 Jews. And he took 40,000 more prisoners. Even here, the Lord, this prophecy, described what would take place hundreds of years later, and yet with such specifics, some by the sword, some by flame, being burnt by fire, some by captivity, some by spoil many days. 8,000 killed by the sword, 40,000 were taken prisoner, another 40,000 were sold as slaves. He plundered the temple, and he robbed it of all of its treasures. Even though the temple still stood, that would not be destroyed until AD 70. Some calculate, by modern calculations, as much as $1 billion worth of treasures that he plundered from the land and took to support his end, his purpose, until the time of the end, because it is still a pretty important time. In other words, this terror would only last as long as God appointed. God had a purpose for it, even in the persecution of the people. It says there in verse 35, to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end. It's talking about them standing really in the righteousness of the Lord Jesus Christ, and for whom the Lord Jesus Christ would come and pay his sin debt. They would not compromise the Spirit of Christ being in them, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. A lot more there. Pray that what we've heard, the Lord will cause us to see his hand in all things in history to his glory and honor.